Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Tuesday, the 24th of June, the year 2014. Jeff Brownfield here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll be talking to Shona Strasser about theater in the wild. Jimmy Koviak will talk about fish traps. Hava Lee from the Gastineau Humane Society will fill us in on their upcoming open house. I'll talk with Jessica Edwards from Haines about this year's Southeast Alaska State Fair. Writers Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. With a forecast for tonight, showers with low temperatures around 50 degrees. Forecast for tomorrow, numerous showers with high temperatures around 58 degrees. Mostly cloudy skies and scattered showers expected on Wednesday night and Thursday. Mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 65 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Chippewa tribes in Wisconsin are asking the Environmental Protection Agency to invoke part of the Clean Water Act to stop mine permitting in the Pinoki Range. Earlier this year, the EPA invoked a section of the act, which for now has stopped the Pebble Mine near Bristol Bay in Alaska. Mike Simonson reports on tribal efforts in Wisconsin.
On May 27th, Red Cliff, Bad River, Lac des Flambeaux, St. Croix, Sakagan, and Lacouture bands sent a letter asking for the same action to stop Gogebic taconite activities in the Pinokies. Lac des Flambeaux President Tom Molson says the EPA has a duty to step in because new state regulations no longer protect wetlands, water supplies, fisheries, and wildlife.
How many times do we have to have pebble mines? How many times do we have to have Crandon mines? You know, how many times do we need to tear up a whole area that's going to impact our wildlife, it's going to impact the devastation of the animals in the ceded territory?
Molson said the tribes need to be out front as they were in a month-long standoff in 1996 when they stopped trains from transporting sulfuric acid through the Bad River Reservation.
We have no move other than if tribes get radical and do the things that have stopped a lot of this year process. Bad River laying on the railroad tracks.
If the EPA agrees, it will halt mining operations until federal regulators decide if a mine in the Pinokies will have an unacceptable effect on the Lake Superior watershed. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
The public comment period ends this month on the Interior Department's proposal to take land into trust for Alaska tribes. Native leaders across the state have voiced support. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Trust status for tribal land protects it from taxation and alienation, the taking or sale of land, and gives tribes greater jurisdiction. However, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, or ANCSA, transferred title to land to for-profit regional and village corporations, not to tribes. Then a Department of Interior Associate Solicitor issued an opinion in 1978 interpreting ANCSA to mean tribes should not be allowed to put lands into trust. Now the courts say that's going to change. Mike Williams, Sr. from ACIAC, says the rule change could help correct problems created by ANCSA.
Not managing our own lands as tribes. Kids that were born after December 18, 1971 are treated differently, and then our hunting and fishing rights were extinguished.
Trust status basically gives tribes control over laws and management of the land, while restricting the power of the state. Proponents of the change hope it will improve public safety. Heather Kendall Miller is the attorney with the Native American Rights Fund who argued the original case of Akiyachuk versus Salazar, which led to the rule change. She's urging people to submit comments telling the Department of the Interior what the rule change would mean to them.
This is an opportunity for them to come forward and to discuss their unique circumstances and why they believe that they may benefit from having lands taken into trust.
The state is appealing the district court judgment. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Members of the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs will focus on economic development Wednesday. An oversight hearing in Washington, D.C. will examine investments in Indian country. Native business leaders are among those scheduled to testify. Today, we remember a Lakota code talker who passed away in June 2010. Clarence Wolfgutz was one of a handful of Native American co-talkers from South Dakota to serve during World War II. He was buried with full military honors at Black Hills National Cemetery. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Supported by Sacred Wind Community Connect, providing scholarships and internet training to the Navajo Nation in Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico. Sacred Wind believes broadband can reinforce Native cultures and offer means for self-determination. SacredWindCommunications.com. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Van, I'm your host, and your first guest in the studio is Shauna Strasser.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Great. I feel so lucky to be able to sit down here with you as the interviewer.
And your mother's in town.
And my mom's in town. I hope she's listening on the radio. She just arrived. Yeah.
So you're here not to talk about your mother.
No.
But like, we can.
We can, but it might be weird.
Theater in the Wild. It's a new Perseverance Theater production. Can you tell me about it, please?
Yeah, well, Theater in the Wild is a brand new, like you said, a brand new education program. And this is for high school age students. So we're looking at 14 to 18 years old. So if you're an incoming, if you're a freshman going into, or your incoming freshman, I guess, in this next school year. Or if you, you know, are just graduated, that's cool too. So this is a program that is, yeah, just for teenagers. We're going out into the woods. We're going to learn some wilderness skills, and we're also going to learn some theater skills, and we're also going to rehearse a play, and then we'll invite community members to come hike out and watch the production.
Do you know what play you're doing in?
You know, we're leaning towards, because we're going to be in the woods, we're leaning towards Midsummer or The Tempest, something that really kind of incorporates what's happening outside to what happens on stage. So we're trying to make that correlation between nature and art, essentially, and theater arts in this case.
Where did the idea come from?
Well, I spend a lot of my time fishing and hiking and playing outside on boats and things. When I'm not doing theater, and that's kind of my favorite things. And about 4 years ago, I was like, oh, I want to do this program. Nobody does this. And I look for all these models across the country, and there's a lot of visual art that's connected with the wilderness because of landscapes and what have you. But people weren't doing any theater outside, and I was like, oh, well, I'll just combine the two things that I love the most and see if that actually will work. And it did take about 4 years to get people behind it, and that's both financial partners and as well as just people in general. They're like, you're crazy. I'm like, yeah, okay, a little bit. But, you know, we wanted to put those things together and see what happens. So if you're a Juneau kid and you love theater, you can go out there and you can learn crazy theater skills, lots of new stuff. But if you're also a Juneau kid who's like, well, I love the wilderness and I can dabble in theater, then you can go out there and do wilderness skills and do some dabbling in theater. And it's an interesting thing. My friend texted me the other day, sent me a message. He's like, oh, Shauna, you, I see you found a way to get paid to go fishing, which I thought was pretty funny.
This is happening at the Eagle River Boy Scout Camp. When is it happening?
Yeah, it's August 3rd through the 9th. So it's 1 week. We'll hike out on a Sunday, and we'll stay out there every night and or every day, and ends on that following Saturday. We'll do some public performances on the Friday before the last day of camp, so we'll invite people to hike out to see our final production.
What's an average day for you?
An average day is the morning, kind of the morning shift. We'll either do kayaking, fishing, hiking. We'll also do we'll also talk with Lyle James, who is a wonderful, wonderful guy, and he'll talk to us about the land that we're on. And so that'll be during the morning time, focus on the wilderness portion. And the afternoon portion, we'll do acting skills, so that might be voice, movement, what have you. And the evening time, we'll rehearse the show. And it's a pretty packed day. And we'll have a fire, of course.
How do you connect theater and outdoor skills?
You know, theater to me is all about responding to your environment. So if I am inside a theater, the thing that I'm responding to are the lights, are the other actors on stage, the sound in the room. It takes listening. The best theater practitioners to me are actually listeners, not necessarily talkers. And they're doers, right? So to act means, you know, like a drama, the word itself means to do. And so for me, being in the wilderness here is the same thing. You know, you have to constantly respond to what's happening around you, especially to be safe and to do, to stay alive, especially in Juneau and Alaska. So for me, they're kind of they just go together. And hopefully the theater will be more creative because of the wilderness. And hopefully the wilderness will, you know, be more tangible because we've experienced art too.
Are you writing any parts for bears?
You know, we might need to write a part for a bear or two, depending. That's the most interesting thing is just, you know, Riley Woodford is going to come out, which is really cool. He's going to talk bear safety with the students and that kind of thing. Maybe he'll play a bear.
Sounds wild.
I love that.
So what kind of young people are you looking for? People with theater experience?
You know, most of the time it's theater kids who are drawn to a theater camp, per se. But I think any kid who is interested in learning about theater, wants to dabble, we will be pretty hardcore in the theater land for sure. But we'll take anybody that's interested, you know, and that wants to really do it. It's an intensive week. So it's not, you know, it's not like a little dabble here and there. But if you want to learn, there's definitely room.
Oh, I've been amazed that people could memorize scripts and plays. How do you teach people the memorization skills?
You know, Jeff, I have to say lately I've been talking to a lot of students about that, but technology has really been the actor's friend. You know, when I first started learning lines, it was just, you know, you just kind of beat a script into you. You know, you sleep with it, you osmosis as much as possible, you know. But now there's apps on the iPhone. There's, you know, all sorts of computer programs.
Tell me more about these apps. What do they do?
Yeah, you can feed your line into, you can, well, some of them, like you can scan your whole script into the app, and then you can black out certain parts. And some of them are vocal, so that they'll give you the cue before, and then you have, you know, room to say the line. And some of them are just ones that you can look at and it'll black out the line. So it's just a natural rehearsal partner, you know, and I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Yeah. I mean, it's very specific market, a unique market for those app users, but it's really cool.
What's the cost?
For the program, it is $400 for the week, and that's all inclusive. So like lodging, meals, transportation, all that kind of stuff.
Is scholarship money available?
Of course. You know, I always say, and Perseverance is definitely of this mind, if you are interested in getting involved, we don't want cost to be inhibitive at all.
How do they get a hold of you in case there's questions?
They can call me at the theater at 364-2421. My extension is 232. You can also check it out online at perseverancetheater.org.
Where do you see this going as opposed to just having a second annual one and a third annual?
What I'd like to do is actually make it into more of a festival-type atmosphere. So maybe we do more than one play. And then I always like it when young people teach other young people. I like to eliminate the me's of the world because I feel like young people know how to talk to young people much better than I do and than adults, you know, do. And so hopefully they can start teaching each other wilderness skills and theater skills.
Shona Stresser, thank you for coming in today. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Nope. Thanks so much, Jeff.
3:16, 3:17, and you are tuned to KTLO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. This week, in honor of Gustavus's 100th anniversary, we've been talking and celebrating things all Gustavian, and the phone with me right now is Jim Mikuliak, talking about Alaska salmon traps. Jim, thank you very much for being on the line with me.
Glad to be here.
So how long have you lived in Gustavus?
About 40 years.
And you wrote a book about it, didn't you?
I did, in the 1980s. I had a little bit of time, and there were a number of old-timers here, people who had homesteaded, and they were, you know, they had a lot of time on their hands, too, and were very happy to tell their stories. So I got a recorder and went around and talked to everyone, and I was, you know, very fortunate to, you know, get this stuff recorded. I was also, I learned that there was a lady who had come here in 1914, one of the Honeymoon Ranch Bunch, and she was alive in Seattle, so I went down to visit her, and I thought, wow, what a great opportunity to, you know, talk with someone who was here in 1914. And I said, boy, we're talking about something. I said, sure, be nice to get, you know, one of your partner's perspective on this. And she said, well, Margaret lives just right across the lake. And she was in an assisted living facility across the lake, Green Lake there. And so I went and visited her, and I talked to her, and I said, it'd be great to get the perspective of a man. And she goes, well, my ex-husband lives up in Arlington. He's 99 years old. And I got to talk to him.
Sounds like you talked to quite a number of people.
I did, yeah.
You also wrote a book about the timber industry and also most recently about Alaska salmon traps, which is right now it's available at Hearthside Books. And I saw you on the Hearthside Cruise talking about the new book. Great book, and you made it digestible for somebody who doesn't know much about salmon traps.
Well, I tried to, yeah. It's a fairly complicated subject, but it's a real interesting subject. It, you know, it deals with one of Alaska's most magnificent resources, salmon. It deals with the fishing industry. It deals with the fight for statehood. And, you know, there's certain ramifications on how fisheries are managed now, you know, how Alaska's constitution was written to guarantee unrestricted access to the fisheries that was later amended with the limited entry legislation.
And could you describe a fish trap for me? It's not like an animal trap that Don Young puts his hand in, is it?
No. Industrial salmon traps were large structures designed to intercept migrating salmon and to funnel them into compartments where they could be held alive until they were needed by the cannery. These traps could be like a half mile long and consisted of a lead, a sort of an underwater fence that extended from shore to the trap itself. And the trap itself consisted of a series of increasingly smaller chambers into which the salmon were funneled. A small watchman's shack was perched on the trap. And these traps took advantage of the fact that salmon tend to migrate with the current along shorelines. The traps were first used in Alaska in the mid-1880s.
How did they differ from native Alaskan traps?
Well, I mean, you had fish wheels in the rivers, and, you know, I mean, everyone's seen pictures of those, and they had basket traps and things. But these were huge industrial structures. I mean, they, like I say, they could be a half mile long.
Where were they located?
The first traps were in Cook Inlet, and eventually they were located all over all along the coastline up, you know, into Bristol Bay. But southeast Alaska was very heavily trapped, and Icy Strait here, where Gustavus is a corridor for salmon, and it was extremely heavily trapped. In 1914, between Excursion Inlet and Point Coverdon, which is, I don't know, maybe 15 miles or something, there were fully 20 traps located there.
Could you describe the relationship of efforts for statehood and fish traps?
Early on, traps were controversial. At first, they were controversial because they were thought to catch too many fish. I have a quote, and William Sulzer was a congressman from New York City, from New York, and his family had interests on Prince of Wales Island, and he called traps the most murderous and iniquitous instrumentalities that were ever devised by the human brain to destroy natural life. In contrast, Chris Bushman, who's a cannery whose father had founded Petersburg, called traps the perfection of methods for catching fish. That was in 1903. The traps came to symbolize, or very early on symbolized, the outside control of Alaska. The canneries were owned by outside interests, the traps were owned by outside interests, and they denied opportunities for Alaskans to participate in the fisheries. And, you know, when Alaska became a territory, a lot of the efforts of the territorial legislature was to, you know, find ways to limit or get rid of traps, and it figured very, very big in statehood. In 1948, there was a referendum, and it was to eliminate fish traps. Should fish traps be eliminated? And it was just advisory. But it was 8-1 in favor, Alaskans favored eliminating fish traps from the territory. When the Constitution was voted on, the Constitution passed voting by like 2-1. There was an ordinance attached to the Constitution to eliminate traps. It passed 4-1. It was very, very big in the effort of Alaskans to become a state.
What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of fish traps?
There's a lot of advantages for cannerymen, for sure. I mean, it allowed them control over their fish. And as well, you know, the fish were held alive until they were needed. So if the cannery needed 20,000 fish to run through its lines for that day, they went to the trap, and assuming they were there, they got 20,000 fish and brought them back, and the fish were relatively fresh. In contrast, the boat, you know, the fishing boat, the fish may have been laying in the bottom of the boat without ice for days before they got to the cannery. So there was a big quality issue. Those are the biggest advantages for the cannerymen there. And I guess I should add as well, when you're dealing with a fleet of boats, you know, the guys could go on strike, boats break down, you know, the weather gets bad, a whole bunch of reasons to, you know, that it wasn't as consistent a supply. So it was a real boon to the cannerymen.
What was their lifespan?
Of a trap?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
the trapping industry in general.
The trapping, I mean, the first traps were used in Alaska, like I said, in 1885. They peaked in the 1920s when there were 799 traps along the coast. And they were eliminated after the 1958 fishing season. And the common thing is said that Alaskans, the first act of Alaska when it became a state was to eliminate the traps. That wasn't really the way it was. The federal government, in sympathy with the desires of Alaskans, eliminated traps ending in 1958. And there were several traps that were allowed to operate near the village of Cake in Angoon. And at Metlakatla, which is the waters around that are an Indian reservation, traps operated until 1991.
What was Gustavus about like this time of year? What was Gustavus like during the fish trap heyday?
You know, the people here really didn't participate in the fisheries much. They really didn't. Again, the traps were owned by out-of-state interests. There were a number of traps along the Gustavus Foreland. There were a number of traps on Point on Pleasant Island, and of course over by Point Adolphus. But really, there wasn't much. You know, wasn't much involvement with the fishing industry. You know, the folks here who were homesteading sold beef and produce to the canneries, but that was pretty much it.
How large of a structure were these things?
Well, the traps could be a half mile long. And I mean, so they were huge. There were two types of traps. There were pile traps, which were kind of rows of piles that were driven into the bottom in a line that was the lead, which is kind of like an underwater fence. And then the trap itself with its enclosures. Southeast Alaska's contribution to fish catching technology was the development in 1907 of the floating trap, in which the trap wire, this kind of glorified chicken wire, heavy duty chicken wire, was hung from floating spruce logs. And, you know, they could use 125,000 board feet of spruce, which is enough to build maybe 10 houses. In the logs there. And they're the remnants of these traps. There's a floating trap that's the remnants of it are on the beach at Gustavus here. There's a couple at the upper end of Excursion Inlet, and I'm sure there's more around on the beaches.
I'm talking with Jim Makoviak from Gustavus. He's written a book called Alaska Salmon Traps. It's available at Hearthside Books. Jim, what interests you about traps? What captures your imagination about them?
Well, I have great interest in the fisheries, but also in Alaska's statehood. And for me, fish trap issue was kind of the low-hanging fruit of Alaska historical subjects. Again, ramifications with how fisheries were managed, the Alaska becoming a state, and you see the remnants of these things, on the beaches here. And there's actually still some piles from pile traps near Point Gustavus.
And Jim, thank you for being on the air with me today. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, thank you very much.
And have a good day.
Bye-bye.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 24th of June, 2014. It's the anniversary of the first exhibition of Picasso's work in Paris, 1901. The summer of 1901 also marked the beginning of his blue period, which lasted for 3 years. His painting, The Old Guitarist, an example of his work then. It's the birthday of novelist Anita Desai, born in Mussoorie, India, 1937. Her mother was German, her father Bengali. She said, "I'm sure this is what makes my writing, whatever it is. I see India through the eyes of my mother as an outsider, but my feelings are my father's of someone born here." She grew up speaking German at home, Hindi with her friends, learned Bengali from her father, listened to Urdu poetry in the street, but she first learned to read and write in school and in English. She said, "I think it had a tremendous effect that the first thing you saw written and the first thing you ever read was English. It seemed to me the language of books. I just went on writing it because I always wanted to belong to this world of books." Anita Desai's most recent book, The Artist of Disappearance, is a collection of short stories. It's the birthday of Pete Hamill, born in Brooklyn, 1935, son of Irish immigrants, oldest of seven kids, dropped out of high school, joined the Navy, was hired by the New York Post as a reporter. He worked a night shift starting at 1 o'clock in the morning at a time when the Post was located on West Street near the waterfront. Newspaper didn't want to spend money on air conditioning, so the reporters worked with the windows open, and all night long they typed and they slapped at insects coming in from the United Fruit Company pier across the street. When he was first hired at the Post, his editor told him, "If you want it to be true, it probably isn't." Later he was promoted to writing a column. Pete Hamill said about his column, "I wanted it to be about common people, good, decent, hard-working, forgotten people in New York City." He said, "We came from a tradition where we were paid to have opinions, but the opinions were based on the reporting. We had been there, whether it was Vietnam or Northern Ireland or the wrong part of town. Now, to me, there's too many columns that are just based on reading the Washington Post that morning and not going anywhere." Pete Hamill in 1967 took a break from reporting to start writing a novel. A year later, he was with his friend Bobby Kennedy when Kennedy was shot and killed in Los Angeles. Pete Hamill helped tackle the gunman. He was so depressed afterward that he wandered around New York, unable to write anything. One day he was telling his friend Paul O'Dwyer about his writer's block, and O'Dwyer said, "You're not important enough to have writer's block." And Hamill laughed and went back to writing. His first novel, a thriller called Killing for Christ. Later books include The Gift, Snow in August, Tabloid City, and a memoir, A Drinking Life. And it was on this day in 1947 the first UFO sighting occurred. A pilot, Kenneth Arnold, flying over the Cascade Mountains, saw a series of objects, silvery, shiny, seemed to be shaped like a pie plate, and so they came to be called flying saucers. Here's a poem for today by Tess Gallagher, Irish Weather. Rain squalls cast sideways, the droplets visible like wheat grains sprayed from the combine. As suddenly, sunshine. If a person behaved this way, we'd call them neurotic. Given weather, we gust and plunder with only small comment. It's raining. Sun's out. Irish weather. Tess Gallagher from her collection Dear Ghosts, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that's been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
The clinic is closed and you or a loved one don't feel well, or you have a health-related question that can't wait. What do you do? Here's the solution. Starting July 1st, Search will have a free after-hours nurse triage line for our patients in Juneau. Search's free after-hours service is available by calling 1-800-613-0560. For life-threatening emergencies, please call 911.
This message brought to you by Search, your partner in health.
Time is 3:32 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown, I'm your host. In the studio with me next is Hava Lee from the Gessner Society, Gessner Humane Society, and they're having an open house tomorrow. Wednesday. Hava Lee, thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks for inviting me, Jeff.
So for people who do not know, can you describe maybe a bit of the history of the Gessner Humane Society?
Oh, my. The history of the Gastineau Humane Society. Let's see. Let's go back to the 1960s, 70s, when a group of people who were really dedicated realized that, you know, Juneau was being overrun by packs of animals that had nowhere to go. They had nowhere to go. They weren't owned by anyone. They weren't cared for by anyone. So this extremely dedicated group started by collecting the animals, taking care of them, and then trying to find homes for them. And then they were given literally a shed under the old Juneau Douglas Bridge. And they started there. The police department and concerned citizens would bring animals in, drop them off, and this group of people would care for them and try to find them homes. And if I could just put in one little plug, a few years ago, the shelter was having a roof replacement and our roof collapsed. And unfortunately, it collapsed also during a huge rainstorm and water flooded into the roof area. And as it flooded in, it destroyed much of our historical data, pictures, and all of that. So if anyone's listening to this and you were involved in the shelter and you could provide us with some of the history, we would really appreciate it, and we would love to have that information. So that's my little plug.
I can just imagine the scene, what's wrong if I don't... Woof, woof, woof.
Yeah, exactly. So then in the 80s, we had a very generous offer of some land on Glacier Highway, where we are now located. And with the help of tremendous help from, again, volunteers and people dedicated to helping animals, the current shelter was built. And we've been there ever since.
How many animals do you go through helping during an average year?
Well, literally hundreds and hundreds, between 500 and 1,000, depending on, you know, how they go through, how they come in. I would say probably closer to the 1,000 mark.
More dogs or more cats?
More cats. More cats always.
What's the oddest animal you've ever brought in?
We had a reticulated python once. I thought that was... interesting. We had a Burmese python. I think these big snakes, when people bring in the big snakes, they're really interesting. When Linda Blefkin was there, they had, I was going to say it was orangutan, and now I'm thinking, was it really orangutan? But it was some kind of large primate. That was an interesting one. Every once in a while, we'll get a scorpion in. But I, for me, the big snakes are the most interesting ones.
You mean chickens?
Yes, we. Now that Juno has a lot of backyard chickens, we have chickens that come in, yes.
Funding, how do you get your funding?
We have two major ways of funding. The Humane Society has a contract with the city and borough to provide animal control services. And the funding for animal control covers just animal control services. So those are just services that are required under Title VIII, and that funding is for that. The rest of the funding that supports the Humane Society comes from donors and supporters, but we also have, I should say three sources, because we also do a lot of, we provide a lot of services that bring funding in to pay for what we do. For example, we have a professional groomer, and we have a room that anybody can bring their dog, their cat, I suppose their reticulated python if they wanted to, and bring it in and bathe it themselves, which really helps on keeping your own bathtub scratch free. And we provide all of the shampoo and conditioners and brushes and towels and, of course, the tub and anything else you need. And we also do boarding, overnight boarding, and we have a doggy daycare program where people can bring their dogs in during the day and they get to go out for walks and play groups and hang out with their friends. We have we sell pet products. So these are some of the things that we do to bring in income to support the Humane Society.
What does it cost to adopt a cat or a dog?
Well, this month is National Pet Adopt a Shelter Cat, Adopt a Shelter Cat Month nationwide. So what we're doing this month is if you adopt a shelter cat, and this is good through the 30th, if you adopt a shelter cat, the adoption fee is a donation. So you make a donation to the Humane Society, and we consider that the adoption fee. And so we cover all the costs of spaying, neutering, vaccinating, microchipping, and caring for them. And you make a donation to us, and we are glad to see our cats go into good homes. The dogs are $125 for adoption. And then everything from, we have some lovely chinchillas right now, if anybody would like to adopt them, and some gerbils, and, you know, there's always all kinds of little critters at the shelter.
Can people come by and just get an animal fix?
Yes, they can come by and get an animal fix, and we have lots of volunteers who do that. In fact, if you want to volunteer, the best thing to do is go onto the internet, check out our website at ghspets.org, click on How to Help, and then on Volunteers, and it will walk you through the whole entire process of how you can be a volunteer. And if you just are out one day and you just say, you know what, I just have to go visit a dog. Just stop into the shelter, and we can find a dog for you to take out for a walk.
Cool. You have an open house tomorrow?
Yes, we are having an open house. The open house is really my thank you to our board, who are tremendous, all of our members, and all of the people in Juneau who, throughout the whole time I've been at the shelter, have been so supportive of me, even when they've been complaining, but I've learned something from each one. And just all of the people who help animals. We've got some tremendous animal groups in town, Grateful Dogs being one of them, that just do lots and lots of stuff to promote animals and animal welfare. So really, I'm hoping that people will come by the shelter between 4 and 6. We have some light appetizers, and I just want to be able to say thank you for my years at the shelter, for helping me and for helping all of our staff, and just for helping animals in general. And, you know, it's just we live in this incredible community, and I think that all of the people who help out at the shelter, you see all of these people there, you know, when somebody needs a helping hand, they're there to they're to help out, and I just want to say thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart to all of them.
How big of a staff do you have?
We have 21 people on our staff, so we have a huge staff. And, you know, they're all involved in all different kinds of things, you know, from grooming to training to caring for the animals. We have a clinic. You know, we have a whole clinic staff with a veterinarian and licensed vet techs. And so we're busy. It's a busy, busy place.
How many times do people adopt an animal and then discover that they really shouldn't have adopted that animal?
You know, that happens occasionally. And we had one just the other day that everything seemed to be going fine at the shelter. And they got their pet home, and it just, for a variety of reasons, it just didn't work out. So they came back, and, you know, we realized that, you know, even sometimes the best of times, it just doesn't work out. And so we're going to help them find another pet that works in their family, and then we'll find this one a home that works for her.
I'm talking with Hava Lee, the executive director of the Gastineau Humane Society, about their open house tomorrow. And then what time is it?
It's from 4 to 6 at the shelter.
Last question. What makes your job fun?
You know, when people come in and they've adopted an animal and they bring it back and they have all these funny stories, that's definitely the fun part of it. And, of course, combined with that is seeing an animal that we've had at the shelter for a long time, finally making that love connection with somebody whose home they're going to go into. Those are the things that make the job really fun.
And how many pets do you have at home?
I have cats, and I have a dog now, and I have a horse, but he's not at my house, but he's at his horse house.
Phone number for the Gastineau Humane Society, please.
The phone number is 789-0260. And again, our website is ghspets, that's PETS.org.
Anything you'd like to add before we go off?
Well, I would like to invite everybody who's in the listening audience to come to the shelter tomorrow between 4 and 6 so I can thank you. And I want to thank Jeff and KTOO and all of the other people in Juneau who support the shelter. Thank you.
Now old Mr. Johnson had troubles of his own. He had a yellow cat who wouldn't leave his home. He tried and he tried to give the cat away. He gave it to a man going far, far away. But the cat came back the very next day. The cat came back. They thought he was the goner, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. Give me a meow, go. Now the man around the corner swore he'd kill the cat on sight. So he loaded up his shotgun with nails and dynamite. He waited and he waited for the cat to come around. 97 pieces of the man is all that they found. But you know, the cat came back the very next day. The cat came back. They thought he was the goner, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. Give me a meow, go. So he gave it to a man going up in a balloon. He told him for to take it to the man in the moon. The balloon came down about 90 miles away. Where the man is now, well, I dare not say. But you know, the cat came back the very next day. The cat came back. They thought he was the goner, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. Give me a meow, go. So he gave it to a man going way out west. He told him for to take it to the one he loved the best. First the train hit the track, then it jumped a rail. Not a soul was left behind to tell the gruesome tale. The cat came back the very next day. The cat came back.
They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. Give me a meow, goat. Now the cat was the possessor of a family of his own, with seven little kittens, till there came a cyclone. It tore the houses all apart and tossed the cat around. The air was filled with kittens, but not one was ever found. But the cat came back the very next day. The cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. Give me a meow, goat. Sing it all again. Now the cat came back the very next day. The cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. Give me a meow, goat. Louder meow. Louder. A little quieter. Quieter meow. Quieter now. Quieter. Quiet as you can.
Fred Penner with a classic song, The Cat Came Back. Time is 3:47. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host. On the phone with me now from Haines is Jessica Edwards from the Southeast Alaska State Fair. Jessica, thank you for being on the air with me today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So the Southeast Alaska State Fair is coming up July 31st through the 3rd of August in Haines. You all ready for it?
We're getting there. We're excited. We're planning.
Some of the highlights for people getting their action gear.
Well, you know, we've got, we're really excited about something new this year. We're putting a lot of energy into our kids area. It's a beautiful grassy area on the north corner of our property, and we're building a new kids stage this year. It's where a lot of the crafts and free activities happen for youth. And so we're excited about a beautiful new building. And in addition to that, we're putting in new carnival game booths. So we'll have some new fun games, and we're going to add some of the games for older kids, some glass-breaking games and, like, hoop shoot and stuff like that. So that's pretty exciting for us. Also really excited about the entertainment this year.
Want to go over that, please?
Sure, yeah. So our headliners, we have Split Lip Brayfield. They're from Wichita, Kansas. They're a blistering fast bluegrass band. I have not been able to get their songs out of my head since I first heard their music this spring. They're really awesome. They're going to play on Saturday night. Right before them, we'll have Vagabond Swing. They're from Lafayette, Louisiana. They're a big band. There's seven or eight of them on stage, and they make a lot of noise. They're really interactive with the crowd. They've got kind of this vaudeville circus kind of horns and strings thing going, which is really fun. And then a lot of buzz about Elephant Revival. They're going to play Friday night. Beautiful music. They're from Colorado. They've got this sort of mountain sound, sort of influenced by bluegrass and other things, but really lovely, beautiful music, fun to dance to, too.
And who else? I know you got some Juno acts.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we've got lots of folks from Juneau. Let's see. Looking down, we've got North Country Cajun Club. They're going to do a great dance. You know, we have that Southeast Got Talent contest on Thursday night, which has become a really popular attraction. And we've added a dance to the slot after the talent show the last couple of years, and that's been fun. So North Country Cajun Club will play there. On Friday, we've got the Quaintrells. I'm not real familiar with them, but I've listened to them a little bit, and they sound really fun. Shiver Twins, a little bit more rockin' also on Friday. And let's see, looking down, Wool Pullers, great act. We had them up for Beer Festival, and they were really fun. Saturday, we've got, let's see, those folks. Playboy Spaceman is going to open for a group called Harrison B at 6:30 on that kind of headliner slot. So it'll be fun to have them, and more throughout the weekend, I'm sure. Those are the ones that come to my head.
And besides the music and the stuff like that, there's arts and animals.
Sure. Yeah, we've got a barn full of animals in McPherson Barn, which is, I love going in there during the fair because the fair is so busy and kind of, it's a lot of energy. And I go in there and I just take a big, deep sigh of relief. There's horses chewing hay and goats, you know, climbing around and chickens gobbling. And so that's cool. That's a fun place to hang out. We have lots of exhibits from all over. We've done a fair bit of promotion in the region, going down to Ketchikan and Sitka this year to try to get folks interested in exhibiting and sending stuff up. So we're hoping for 1,000 arts and crafts exhibits in Harriet Hall. Those are all displayed nicely in there, fun to walk around and see the beautiful creative stuff that people are doing. And I should mention that our Juno deadline is going to be July 15th for creative arts and crafts exhibits. And folks can drop them off at the Cooperative Extension office. I think it's on Whittier Street now, but I have a phone number for that if I can say that on the air. It's 523-3280, and the agent there in charge is Sarah Lewis. So any questions that people have about exhibiting, they can call the fair office and we can put them in touch with the right folks. But I'm trying to get a bunch of beautiful things in Harriet Hall for people to look at.
What kind of special events do you have going?
Lots and lots of contests. So fun. Like the Southeast Got Talent contest I mentioned on Thursday, that's something that people can enter. It's really great. And then Friday we've got a singer-songwriter competition. That's a real favorite. It's gotten really popular. You submit your songs and you play for 5 minutes and you have a panel of judges and there's a winner chosen that gets to play on the main stage later that day. Other things on Friday are we have a 5K adventure run that's gotten super popular. This year it's called Unleash Your Beast 5K adventure run. And so that's, getting muddy and climbing over obstacles and running around in the backwoods of the fair. It's really gotten some great reviews too. It's very tiring, however. And then a lot of the things that people really, I'll just mention a couple others. We've got the parade on Saturday. We've got the logging show. We've got a fisherman's rodeo, which is series of contests around fishing typey things, and lots and lots more.
Does the parade in Haines go twice around the same perimeter?
It takes about 20 minutes, yes. So it goes and starts at the fire hall, and then it goes up 3rd Avenue there by the Mountain Market and the Hainesboro Library. It goes down Main Street, which is just a blip, and then down around in it. So it makes two laps. Yep. It's a pretty short thing, but it's fun.
How long has the Southeast Alaska Stage Fair been around, and how did it get started?
Oh, man, this is the 46th year, and boy, has it changed. It started in 1969. The Chilkat Valley Homemakers Club had a little exhibit display in the American Legion building here, and it was probably a couple hundred entries. It moved to a property in the mid-70s and had a horse show, and then it became a music festival. Chilkat Bald Eagle Music Festival kind of was part of the fair in the 90s and early 2000s, and now we have today this event that kind of encompasses it all. So it has had a neat history, and what we are today really reflects the long years and the many iterations.
And you replaced the canvas tent cover with a metal one, a real roof.
Yes. Yeah, we have a roof.
That's a long time ago, because that's when I got there first.
Yeah, we have a metal roof. It's nice. And, I think what's kind of cool, too, is that we've been able to do things like last year we added a stage over near the kids area that has been quite popular. It's a park, so you can kind of, if it's a nice day, you can sit in the grass and watch music. And if it's not, there's a tent out front. But we've added venues. So I really feel like since I've been coming to the fair, since 2000, it's really filled up. There's something to do everywhere you look. There's an activity or an attraction or something happening, and you can't see it all in a day or 2 days. I just really like that about how it's come this at this point.
We should talk about the food a little bit.
Oh, fair food. We have a couple new food vendors this year. We have some great returning vendors, and we have some new food vendors. So I'll mention that we will be having Southern food this year, which I'm really excited to try. That'll be a new food option. And we're going to have a booth that specializes in fried delights, which is always a good thing to have at fairs, get a little bellyache going. We'll have sushi and Mexican food and pizza, espresso to kind of perk you up in the middle of the day when you've had a little too much of the funnel cake, and corn on the cob and smoothies and all sorts of sweets. So lots to eat on the fairgrounds.
Is the ferry schedule accommodating?
Pretty much, yes. It's looking pretty good. The boats will arrive, it looks like, every day around 11. The fair opens at noon, except on Saturday it opens at 11:30. So boats will arrive here at 11 from Juneau, and then they depart It's at 5 o'clock hour, and there's extra boats on Monday for folks who want to stay the whole weekend. There's two fair weather runs between Haines and Juneau to accommodate.
And speaking of accommodate and where people can stay, are there accommodations available?
You know, there are still some rooms available. We've actually had quite the budding of a vacation rental by owner and a B&B market here in Haines as we lost a couple of the older hotels. Folks have figured out that they can rent rooms. So the best thing for folks that are looking for accommodations, they can call the fair office. We're happy to help. But the visitor center here keeps an up-to-date list of rooms available, and the lodging in Haines is really good about keeping in touch with the visitor center so that they can keep that list really active. And their number is 766-2234. Again, I'm happy to help with that as well if anybody wants to call the fair office.
And that number is 766-2476, as it has been for many years.
Mm-hmm, correct. Yep.
Jessica Edwards, thank you so much for being on the air with me today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. Stretching across a good portion of southern New Jersey lies a region known as the Pine Barrens, with broad tracts of pine forest interspersed with grassland and shrubland. The Pine Barrens remain one of the largest expanses of green in the Northeast. So, why do we call so green a region a barrens? Early European settlers tried farming here, but the sandy, acidic soil wasn't suited to their traditional crops. Because the land proved unproductive for them, they called it barren. The name stuck. Despite their gloomy name, the New Jersey Pine Barrens support a diversity of plants and animals. Bright yellow prairie warblers trill atop young pines. Great crested flycatchers call out overhead. Upland sandpipers, a scarce and threatened species, nest in open grasslands. For the Pine Barrens and its native habitats, agricultural barrenness has proven a saving grace. If its soils grew traditional crops, it would have, centuries ago, disappeared beneath the plow. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Time is 3:58 and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau. Coming up tomorrow on the Juneau Afternoon, Ken Fix will be your host. We'll get details about Perseverance Theater's Summerfest. We'll talk with Joanne and Dave Lesh about the Gustavus Inn. We'll continue our Fish 101 series as we discuss fly fishing with Brad Elfers. And Mary Fitzgerald and Jonna Brewster will be here to highlight the Front Street Community Health Center. That Bruno Reddit's Almanac and more tomorrow at 3 on the Juneau Afternoon. And coming up next is All Things Considered.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 8.